Hello and welcome to Chips of Chorlton. I'm Neil Wright and I am joined by Duncan.
Hi.
And Andy.
Hello.
From the band Dutch Uncles. How are you guys?
More right, thank you. Yeah.
You okay?
Not too bad.
7 out of 10.
Seven out of 10.
Solid 7 out of 10.
Yeah. This episode, we interviewed our friend, Francis Lung.
Yes, I think it's been a long time coming, to be honest. Ever since he signed to Memphis Industries, I felt like this podcast was always written in the stars.
Yeah,
somewhere.
Definitely.
Yeah, it was.
Somehow.
Yeah, and we should really time our podcasts with the release of his records to give him some, like, you know.
Well, I think we should just generally just time our podcasts.
Yes,
we should really, at the moment, our output's very sporadic.
Very sporadic. There are,
apologies to anyone who's frustrated at the fact that we don't just put an episode out every 2 or 3 weeks. We are trying.
We are trying. We've got very busy at the moment.
You've got things to do, Neil. You've got to set up your wireless doorbell and all that sort of stuff.
My dad tech.
It was like dad tech, yeah.
Yeah, basically. So we went to the Beagle to chat
For a fourth time? In regards to different guests, because we've been there so many times now and not reviewed the chips.
Right.
Either because the review's been a disgrace, or we've been a disgrace, and the episode itself hasn't gone out. Yeah. So we've finally done it.
And what did we forget to do during the interview?
We forgot to review the chips.
Yes, we did.
So I, if you guys don't mind, four words.
Please.
Sure.
Great chips, great gravy.
And a thumbs up.
It's a sort of vibrating thumbs up.
I'm actually looking at Neil very intently, shaking a thumbs up at him.
Yeah, they were good. Yeah, well, I have a real sort of love-hate relationship with the Beagle. But yeah, the chips were good. Can't really complain. Thought it was all right.
Yep.
It was totally fine.
I'd go with that.
We were supposed to review the Wetherspoons chips again because we've not done that since episode uno, which is one.
Day dot.
And yeah,
thanks for clarifying that.
Yeah. And I'd kind of forgotten. I mean, I've not forgotten how great the Wetherspoons chips are, but obviously it's been a bit of a hostile environment there of late, politically speaking.
Yeah.
So we've sort of avoided that place for a while, and we thought, you know, this could be a good time to go back there. And, you know, Francis, he's Chorlton. We could go take it back to Day Dot.
Yep.
And then me and him were sat there waiting for you guys to show up. We were about to order a second pint, thinking you guys were absurdly late. We're there in the midst, right in the middle of the rabble of Curry Club. It was going to be the Curry Club
review, and
we've not done the Curry Club review.
Yeah, we'll have to circle back to that.
Yeah, we need to go back. Like, first of all, Wetherspoons needs to get some electrical points, which is why you weren't there.
Yeah.
And secondly, we do need to go back and do the Curry Club review.
It's not the Curry Clubs of Chorlton podcast, though, is it?
But you can get chips with them. Just think of the curry as a big dip.
A big deal. So, how do we know Francis Lung?
It's been it's a very old story. Old? It's a very long story.
What the fuck is wrong with it?
Back
to the days of yore. Back to the tapestries of Manchester bands just shithousing around.
It'd be great to make the Manchester band Tapestry.
Yeah, I wonder what Star and Gart would look great on a tapestry, actually. You could see that.
The river of piss coming down.
And it had the sort of impending doom of a new train station platform.
Well, it has quite a Normandy feel about it when you think about it. So don't think about it.
No.
But yes, we've known Francis. I want to call him Tom because
his real name is Tom.
But we'll call him Francis. Yeah. That's his artist name. We've known Francis for years. We've known them since the very beginning, before they were Woo Life, even before they were Woolf, and they supported us on our very first album launch gig at Deaf Institute back in 2009.
Yep.
So before then, me and Rodin were witness to their very first gig, we're pretty sure, at Tiger Lounge back when they were called Vagina Wolf. And you could see straight away, as is mentioned in this episode, that there was just raw talent from the start. You knew that these guys were going to change the complexion of what Manchester has to offer. Because I think before then, to me, what Manchester represented was something between, as Orphan Boy claimed it to be, council pop. You know, that's their words for it, not mine, but I can see what that means within council pop. There was a mixture between that and bookish enemy indie. So you either had the Cortinas at one end, and then you also had Polytechnic at another end, is what was going on.
Yes.
In terms of guitar music, it felt like those were the two avenues that Manchester had to offer.
Okay.
And then what Vagina Wolf did, just four college kids, still at Zavarian College in Rusholme, came out and just completely changed that complexion. And they hadn't even found their sound yet at that point. They hadn't introduced the organ. They hadn't brought in all the reverb. Not that that's as simple as it is, because it's never that simple. Yeah. But even what they had to offer on that first gig, you just knew something was different. It was like a, as a reference in the episode, it was a bit like an indie James Brown. Yeah. Like speaking of Ellery's style specifically, but that's a compliment. I don't mean that in any way that's meant to downplay it whatsoever.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of something he might be the godfather of. The godfather of growl.
God, that shit.
That stays in.
That's it. There we go.
Yeah, edit that out. Yeah, yeah. Right, I'll stop saying that. But so that's when we first met them, and it was great to get in at the ground floor with it. I remember we were really supportive of them, and I don't, one way or another, bumping into them either at gigs or just going to every gig that they did, because I remember just being fascinated by what they were doing, wanting to be there every time. Very much like I'm with Working Men's Club, although now I'm in my 30s and I've got various jobs to do, so I never get to go and watch them play. Yeah. But it's one of those things where every time they play, you want to be there. And I remember getting a demo off them of tunes that they had with their manager, who was at the time Graham from Blowout Records. And like, these songs were three of the songs that were going to end up on the first Wii Life album, but this is before, as I say, all those production techniques came through. I've forgotten what my point was now. I've had a Magnus.
they were dead good, really.
Basically, it was just dead good. Yeah, and you knew it was dead good.
So I suppose we were talking before. We speak in the podcast a lot about Francis's experience of Letterman.
Yeah.
When Wu Life played Letterman, it was a real fuck me moment, wasn't it? It was because we were talking before, weren't we, about all those bands that we've seen on Letterman.
I didn't believe it. When I heard that it was happening, I just didn't believe it was going to happen.
It was sort of one of those things where, you know, you hear a lot of things about new bands and what they might do and, you know, what might be on the cards for them. But when that was confirmed, it was just like, Jesus, this is real.
This is
real sort of like incredibly high profile stuff. I suppose obviously it adds to the hype and it adds to the feeling of something new happening.
Yep.
But it was pretty insane that happened, really.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, especially when you consider, I suppose as well, for the time frame we're talking about here, because we're talking about the very... That's fine. We're talking about the very start of Wu Life, and then we're going from the start of Wu Life straight to the Letterman performance. And when we're looking at the start of Wu Life, Letterman was pretty much the only outlet that anyone had to see what bands were worth on stage, unless you were at a gig, you know, like that was like the global Jules Holland in many respects, even though Francis says that Jules Holland is very well received in America, which is something I'd never heard about, to be honest. Like,
it's probably a feeling of a more sort of like artsy highbrow vibe about it compared to Letterman, I guess. But yeah, I mean, it's, obviously, Francis says a lot about this in the podcast, but it's amazing how bare it is, and it is just a studio with lights in the middle of the fucking day, and you've got to try and summon a sort of career-defining performance out
there.
It sounds like the least inspiring thing ever.
And one that matches the legacy of the show. They went on way before the Future Islands had their moment on the whole thing, but as I say before, my first experiences of Letterman were watching, were just like staying up late, kind of researching Talking Heads performances on there, or when the Strokes were doing like residencies on there for the Room on Fire album. And you start to realise how important this stage is. Even though it's only one band a night, it really matters and it's really focused. And it's the perfect magnification for any band's career, certainly in the US, but also globally.
Yep.
And then I remember when the time we went to America for New York Sound City and South by Southwest, I actually remember feeling like, this is my problem here totally, but I remember Dan, our manager at the time, sort of going, well, we might be able to get Letterman or something like that. And I remember thinking, let's not cheapen it like that. Like, I don't think that's something we're going to be quite up to scratch to.
Yeah, yeah.
It's absolutely bonkers to think that as well, considering it was just before South by Southwest.
Yeah.
And the international bands that would be in the country at that point as well.
There'd be no one about.
You never know.
You can imagine the absolute traffic going on. But I think Francis really sheds light on the size of the occasion really well.
Yeah, it's a really good... He explains it really well. And I suppose the last thing I want to touch on before we play the interview is he came on tour with you when he left Wu Life, or Wu Life split off, started a solo band and came and tour with you. And a thing that we didn't discuss on the podcast, because we were speaking about it with France, from Francis' angle, was that tour was a really breakthrough tour for you guys, wasn't it? The Out of Touch and the Wild tour, the first sort of run of shows you did then, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I think in a way, not to sound like our lives are the be-all and end-all. I mean, they are in terms of this podcast universe, because without it, there's no podcast. But I do love the symmetry of Francis being there with us during possibly our most successful stint of touring.
Well, certainly the most organic.
And whilst we've been there at the most promising moments of his.
Yeah.
And it's been a pleasure to keep playing with him, because as you say, he joined us on the Out of Touch in the Wild tour back in 2012?
Yep.
2013, sorry. I always forget, because there was that 6 month wait we had, and I think all of our body clocks just messed up at that time.
Yeah.
But then he also supported us on our last tour as well.
Dance
he
House.
He was there at the Dance House doing a fine job of once again stealing your Gregs.
Kept stealing my rider. Like,
there was a Gregs next door as well.
I know.
Sue Rider
in his eyes
is what we don't say, because it's problematic more than anything else, especially when it sounds that ignorant. But
okay, so here we go, our interview with Francis Lung.
So let's introduce Francis Lung in the house.
Hi mate.
Hey,
how are you doing?
What you been up to? What's going on?
So what is it like, getting towards February now? I guess music wise I just like booked some studio time to make another record, so that's pretty exciting.
Yay!
Yeah, we were talking about it before. You're going to Giant Wafer in deepest, darkest Mid Wales.
The infamous.
Oops.
Because when you think about it, like, an album announced is a big deal, right?
Yeah, but I think you can say when you're going to record.
But when I've got as much in common as I have with you guys, recording wise, producer wise, it's cool. I want to talk about it. So we're going to go. Yeah. Gonna go record a new record in Giant Wafer in Wales, where Dutch Uncle's recorded
in the deepest, darkest neck of Newtown.
Yes,
or no
exactly.
less. We the infamous, incorrigible intransigence Giant Wafer.
So why did you choose Giant Wafer? Was it off the recommendation of Brendan?
It's sort of like a second skin to Brendan. He wears it well.
So Brendan Williams, for the listener, is producer of Dutch Uncle's record and also your first record, isn't
he? Yeah, that's right.
Talented man / lecturer / he is all around chirpy fella.
He's a polymath.
He has dived deep into the wafer with us twice on Out of Touch in the Wild and Oh Should It. Well, it's not a euphemism.
No, it's not. It really isn't. No.
I mean, we love that place. We were considering booking out for a stag do.
What?
I mean, imagine
imagine the record you'd make.
Well, exactly. Imagine letting the stag do happen, and you just press record.
And then at the end of it,
you're greeted by these amazing tunes.
Would it be in stereo?
Hi, sorry.
That's the real question.
It's all right. The tacos have arrived.
Tacos. Thank you very much. Cheers.
Thank you. My vegan tacos have arrived. Rock and roll.
Definitely.
And the chips are coming. You are in for a treat. We are finally going to review the Beagle chips. I think we've tried and failed on three different occasions.
Yeah,
we haven't.
We've either taken it out entirely, or we've just dissed the we completely just burnt those episodes somewhere.
Well, the first time was with Mike Fennart, and he turned up like an hour late after we'd had the chips, so we couldn't obviously.
True.
And then that's so that kind of put the kibosh on.
You can't really review a cold chip.
So I saw Mike Fennart in Soup Kitchen the other week.
Really?
Oh, I got a funny story about
him,
actually.
In our Soup Kitchen or in Soup Kitchen?
The Soup Kitchen. He's doing all right, don't worry.
Was it field music?
I got there so late. I'm sorry, field music. They put me on the bloody list, and I really wanted to see them because I love them. And we're label mates.
Now you're label buds. First name terms,
I was
right?
making pizza. I was making pizza for my friends. Time kind of got away with me, and I realized that I should go and watch the gig now. It was about 9 o'clock. I thought, oh, maybe they'll have just gone on. Of course, it's like a Piccadilly outstore, and it starts at 7.
Yeah. And there's no support. You could not find a more prompter band than Field Music. They'll be on 5 minutes before stage time.
They want to get it started on time so that they can go home.
So they can drive back to Sunderland.
They can end it
every time.
They got shit to do.
Yeah, exactly. They got real lives.
Yeah.
So what,
Neil? You've got a real life.
I know. I'm surprised I actually make it to the pub now. You know what I mean, with the kids and the job I have. But Interesting story about Mike Fennart, did you say? Have you got something?
Oh, yeah, sorry. So, yeah, so I was going to watch this show. I was going to watch Field Music, and they were played at 7, and I got there at 9. And I actually watched them drive around the corner in the van before I even got onto Spear Street, where Stoop Kitchen is. Yeah. It was pretty heartbreaking. I saw, like Peter Brewis in the front of the van, like, texting. Just, like, probably texting his wife. I don't know.
Yeah.
Just, like, hearing about what his kids had done for the day. And I walked into the bar, like, by myself, like, all right, I'm not going to drink. I'm just going to get a Coke. I'm just going to, like, hang out and then go home. And then, like, and then Mike Vennett's there. And it's like, hey, how you doing? And it's like, yeah, I'm really good. It's nice to see you. Because I used to work in Head Over Heels, which is, like, a kids' play center down the road from Morrison's.
I genuinely thought you guys knew each other through music. Going to be a children's crush.
That's funny, really, because like I know Mike Vennett because he walked into the kids' play center, like I was a receptionist, and he walked in there with like a Fender T-shirt on.
Oh right.
And I was like, so bored. It's such a boring job. But then in walks this guy with like a Fender T-shirt, and we get talking, and then like he was a bit closed, and every so often, every Tuesday or whenever he came in, we just open up a bit more about music, and when I saw him. And I learned that he was with Biffy and then all of his post-rock background. In fact, if you Google post-rock Manchester, there's only two bands that come up. And it's his band and Wu Lai.
Really? Is it really?
So I looked that up the other week and I was like, that's really funny.
Yeah, you guys were post-rock. You had vocals.
Oh, you can have vocals and be post-rock.
So did Oceanside as well. Yeah.
Oceanside and Wu Lai, if that's who turned up.
There you go.
And yeah, so I saw him the other night and he was like... He was like, "Oh, I'm talking to Mark Riley. Yeah. He hates my music. He hates it. I'm just being a bit of a C word, you know. Yeah. I'm just telling him to listen to my music. I don't even care anymore. I'm just buying him a pint right now, actually.
And it's amazing.
We love Mike Fennart, don't we? He was so funny.
He had some fantastic anecdotes. Yeah. Well, you know, regular listeners will know, but some of the funniest.
Yeah.
Anecdotes from the indie world, I probably
from the indie world. I'm talking of the indie world as we're sort of crept into sort of Wu Life territory. You guys started, or you met Dutch Uncles when you were a member of Wu Life, weren't you?
Of course, yeah.
Well, I was talking about it because obviously we had a miscommunication as to where we were doing this effing episode. So me and Francis have already been chin wagging in spoons for half an hour, thinking we were going to finally review the Curry Club.
Oh damn!
And it's not happened. But whilst we were chatting about that, we were talking about the fact that me and Robin in Dutch Uncles, we were pretty much... I was wondering, was it your first ever gig, that one at Tiger Lounge, or was it one of your first gigs? Back when
Wu Life. It definitely one of.
Back when it was... You were called Vagina Wolf back then.
Yeah, so I think maybe... I'm definitely going to be wrong here, but one of the only other gigs we'd played at that point was in the Castle... So Manchester listeners...
Like but I remember
the Castle, like, way back when...
Yeah,
I
was at that one too. Did you only play the Castle once back then?
Pretty sure. And
when it used to have a piano at the back of the room.
Yeah. And when it was, you know, the area that's all nicely kitted out now.
Yeah.
Like it was horrible, and there was just a dripping bucket.
And
you had to, you played too.
The toilet was to the right by the side.
Yeah. So you were playing, and then someone would come past you to go to the toilet, you didn't even exist.
Yeah.
We were literally writhing around on the floor, like playing, you know, God knows what. Yeah. Like probably a Nick Cave cover we used to do.
Yeah.
And then, like, this lady's toilet was next to us, and we were just, like, you know, playing, like, for our lives. And then this lady was just skirting past us, trying not to get her shoes wet. Just like, sorry, I've got to go.
Gotta go.
Yeah. She had to go.
Yeah.
She had to go. But that's when we sort of we were witness to the birth of it then in that respect, not to try and claim cool points here or anything like that. But me and Robert at that gig at Tiger Lounge, I remember being at that gig at the Castle afterwards because I remember thinking at the Tiger Lounge, like, this band are going to change things, like, in Manchester. You could tell that you guys, you know, the phrase raw talent is used by a lot of idiots, and I'm going to use it right now. But it was raw talent, and you could see that there was something there. It was like, this is blistering stuff. Yeah, but then I think it went, and then so you were Vagina Wolf, and then you were Woolof Woolof. I think that's what you were called when you supported us. And then at some point, I don't know whether we got you in touch with Sunshine Studios to practice with. You shared a room with the Answering Machine, didn't you? You didn't share it with us.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think what I'm trying to get at is, yeah, is there any money for like kind of previous management appropriations here or anything like that?
You want some rent?
I'm making it sound as if I set you up.
That's so funny. Yeah, so basically like Dutch Uncles were super lovely friends and people to us, and they just totally took us under our wing. They were absolute like veterans of the scene. And I remember being super young and not being able to really play anything. I played drums pretty well, but nothing else. I was I was really inexperienced when I joined Woo Life. I barely could even play guitar, never mind bass, which I ended up playing. But I remember going to what was that cafe that was next to where Albert Hall is now?
We talked about the City. Was this the In the City gig that we
did? Imagine so. Yeah, the In the City rings a bell. So yes, these guys, Dutch Uncles, were playing. This was like the period when you did that Face In single that was amazing. I remember at the time, like, everyone was like, oh my God, it's such a great song. Ooh, yeah. And so, oh, the chips have arrived.
I feel like
I should say
thanks
this.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Cool.
Cheers.
Thank you.
And so I just remember watching Dutch Uncles for the first time, and I was like, oh my God, this is a real band. They can play.
They really got silk shirts.
They got chops, you know. That's what I remember saying to, like, between us. They got chops. Like, there was,
oh yeah, I mean, Rob did have some hefty mutton chops.
Rob did literally have mutton chops.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Yeah, that whole suspenders
it
era
is inspiring,
a bit odd
for me. Yeah,
but he can defend himself on the next episode, I'm sure.
I mean, we did a show that actually didn't make it to the make it onto the internet. Multiple reasons. Well, probably wasn't very good, and I was ill and I couldn't mix it down. We were talking about the best albums of the last decade, and we mentioned that the Woo Life record made it into Pitchfork's top 200.
I think we got like 199.
Yes,
scraped it.
So it was a quick scroll, but
that's good. I didn't have to go very far to read it.
Yeah, but we all know. Yeah. No, hold on. We all know the impact that being 199 on a top 200 list is. It's like when you're number 50 on the Enemy Cool list. Not that any of us would ever know. Were you ever on the Enemy Cool list?
Ellery
got it. Of course he did.
Bloody hell.
Yeah.
He was like 10 or something. He did really well.
Wow.
Is that doing well?
Yeah. I think that's well. I mean, it's entirely subjective, it's subjectively well.
Yeah, but we used to gauge our entire sort of musings on music around the Enemy and its lists.
I think we wrote
it. It used to be so important.
I think we wrote it off after we saw Hewitt in that list.
Oh yeah,
no,
that was the same issue.
Wait a minute.
Okay. He's still up there.
Old man Hewitt.
That guy owes me 20 pints.
20 pints.
What's your overriding memory of that period of your music career with Woo Life, short albeit? You know, do you think, and with this kind of, you know, 199, what's your thoughts reflecting on it now?
I learned everything.
Yeah?
If you want some context, like, me and Ellery were friends when we were 11 years old. We used to skateboard together through a mutual friend called Stefan that I had in high school. He was the only other kid that I knew in school that skated, and then I went skating with him in Ramsbottom, and I met this other guy, this Ellery guy, that I thought was really weird, to be honest. He was really quiet.
Yeah.
Really quiet kid, and we used to go to the skate park, and I maybe swore in front of his dad, and then like Stefan was like, you don't swear in front of Ellery's dad, because he will. So I had this, like, you know, I guess I had a strange impression of this guy. I liked him. He was cool. He was just really quiet. I lost touch with Stefan after he stopped skateboarding, and then so I lost touch with Ellery, and I didn't see him again for years until I went to college. Or maybe even a little bit before, because some of my high school friends used to go out in Rami. You start drinking cider and
Rami,
God knows what else.
Yeah,
well, Ramsbottom.
Ramsbottom.
You don't call it Rami.
I've never heard Rami before.
No, I call it Ramsbottom.
Well, it's because you've never been.
You know, ooh, what? Yes. Even though I have been once, I'll agree with that statement. have I truly ever been to Ramsbottom?
I don't think you have. If you've never been to Zadie's, you've never been to Rammy.
It's going
to
blow my mind all night.
So basically, we were going out in Rammy with my high school friends. Sorry, yes, this is before college. It's hard to remember. 30 now.
It's all right. It's only your life.
And basically, some house party in Ramsbottom, Ellery turned up, and I was like, I know you.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, yeah, I know you as well.
But he said it and like James Brown.
And then he said, hit me. And it was at this... The party was at his parents' place, and there was a drum kit upstairs, and it was like a jam. Like, everyone used to jam, which is something I really miss. Like, back in the day in Rammy, people used to get together and jam musically. Yeah. Like, you would really jam.
Like, originals or covers?
It was a jam.
Anything. Yeah, they see, this is why I can't jam.
Well, we have no jam precedent.
We had a couple of similar parties like that at Pete's house.
That's true.
We'd only ever just do the entire Interpol back catalogue. That
darkness.
Was it. And the darkness. I'd leave at that point.
Yeah.
Carry on.
Well, basically, we would just get up there. I mean, I guess it was kind of bluesy a lot of the time.
Yeah.
I love playing drums. Like, all I did from the age of, 14, 15 onwards was play drums. 14 to, 18, that's all I did before I started playing other instruments. And so, at the time, I would have the opportunity to play a drum kit. I would do it all night. I wouldn't let anyone else have a go.
Yeah.
And then, I didn't particularly enjoy playing with other people until Ellery started playing. And it was like, whoa, what is this guy doing? Like, he was doing stuff on the guitar that I'd never heard anyone do before. Yeah. It was very original, you know. He would, just bend all these notes and just be totally, badass and be,
He'd wear it
well. Really bluesy. Like, he was, everyone played, bluesy, but then he played, what? I imagine it'd be like to play with someone like Muddy Waters or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I know he was really influenced by that. And so it made me dig in and play, and then I was like, oh, you should start a band with me, or you should, I think I already had a band, you should join my band. So So we're going to band, and then
Crazy.
I mean, I don't even know where I am now. And but then, after
so
that,
Evans,
we went to
how
college.
How did Evans and Joe come into the mix then?
After that, we went to college, and so so me and Ellery were in this band, and then Ellery, when he was in college, he met Joe, who's the drummer of Woo Life. He met him in art class, and Joe had a band with Evans, who's more of a high school friend, because Evans moved over from Italy when he was about 11.
Yeah.
And so they grew up in high school together, Evans and Joe, and listened to all this music and, you know, became best friends. So Ellery joined Joe's band. And then, I said to Ellery one night, what are you doing? And he said, oh, I'm going to Joe's house. And I was like, oh, can I come? I'm just a tag along, you know. So I tagged along, and we got really wasted one night. I think I was 18, so I could buy them alcohol. So I bought us all booze, and then I stayed over at Joe's. And they had band practice the next day. And they were like, oh, yeah, so we're going to have a band practice now. And I was like, okay, I'll... kind of stick around. I can play guitar, you know.
Yeah,
maybe
yeah.
I can.
But you kind of knew that that was sort of... Looking back on that, do you think that you kind of pushed yourself into this space knowing that that was going to happen?
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
I think I was in about 10 different bands.
Yeah.
That was kind of a hobby of mine, just joining bands.
Yeah.
At the same time, I was in a hardcore band playing drums. I had a solo project by the time I was 17, 18. And I was also in some of the college friends metal band, helping them write riffs to be, you know, a metal band and God knows how many other things.
Yeah.
I was in the college jazz band as well, playing drums in that. And I just couldn't get enough.
Oh yeah, I did a bit of that. I was in the swing band for a bit.
Oh yeah.
But I got fucking ditched for someone. I think I tried to be the fresh transfer, tried to come in and take someone's swing band drumming job. And
really?
Then they had me on for a bit of I was a bit of an arrogant fucker in school.
Yeah.
So just came on, did a drum solo, and they were like, yeah, you're done now. You can, you know, we'll get the swing standard guy back in. To be fair, it was better. It's more disciplined.
It's tough if you don't read music.
Before we found ourselves in our first conglomeration of musicians, band.
Wow.
Sorry. Wow. I was, you know, I remember I tried to start a band with the bassist of the Marple Hall swing band, and I just remember we were trying to do a cover of Reptilia at my house, and I was like, stop doing it in swing and stop using your fingers. It's not even that bit, it's just the very beginning, like, it's like, what are you doing?
We can't even get the strokes.
We can't even get. Have you heard yourself, man?
That sounds sick.
Yeah, yeah. Was that a jam? Was that a jam just then? Did we do a jam?
I think we jammed.
It would work, actually.
Like the way you walked in.
Hey, baby, the room's on fire.
By the way,
sorry, we've lost
Duncan. Duncan got a pint before and he had a chip in his glass, which I thought was really fitting.
I had a chip in my glass, so I took it back, and instead of a fresh pint being poured, the same pint's been decanted into a fresh glass, so the whole object of the purpose is defeated. Straight. But it's fine. At least there's no chip in the glass. But you're right, chips are Cholton. Not those chips, though. These chips are lovely.
It's back to you, Tom. Sorry.
So I guess we're back at Joe's house. I'd stayed over, they were having a band practice, and I went downstairs, and like I was pretty good at like playing along with songs, so I could make stuff up and jam, because you know I had all that practice. So that's what I did. I just played along with what they were doing and made stuff up, and they were like, somehow I got invited back the next week, and
yeah,
I went from there, you know.
Yeah.
I got evicted from guitar after a little while, because
you were bass.
Well, this
time,
not originally.
Yeah, no, but
originally
by the time Vagina Wolf came along and made its first statement, you were on bass.
Yeah, because we had a guy that was helping us out.
Was it Graham?
So Graham was helping us out.
Yeah, Graham from Graham, for our listeners, just for the knowledge, don't know where my words are going today. He used to run Blowout Records, and he also used to run the Blowout All Day. Yeah, so yeah. If you are, that's probably not going to make sense to anyone under 40. Yeah. No. There used to be like he was a gig promoter, Blowout Promotions, wasn't it?
Well,
and they used to do big All Days at Cholton Irish Centre and around.
Kaiser, put the Kaiser Chiefs on in Cholton.
Did he?
Yeah, at the Irish Centre.
Wow,
for a quid. Yeah. Unbelievable.
What you mean they played for a quid, or it was a quid?
No, it cost a quid to get in.
He put the Killers on at the Beer Keller.
And he played for a quid?
Yeah, he did.
He put the Killers on at the Beer Keller?
He did.
Killers on at the Beer Keller.
He put Block Party as well at the
Block
Beer Keller.
Block Party.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, no, because we played it. I remember when we finally played a blowout night, we were just like, bloody hell, we've made it.
Yeah,
I mean,
much.
We've said that many times in our lives.
We've said we've made it at pretty much every, the lightest milestones.
I'm saying it to this pint.
Yeah, yeah.
Bloody hell,
great
pint.
No more chip glass, you've made it.
Exactly, so no chip glasses.
Yeah, so from those jams, what's the timescale to Vagina Wolf at Tiger Lounge?
Oh, okay. Not very long.
Yeah, straight in.
I think like, so we were... How old? Maybe like 16. So we were about 16 when we were doing those first jams at Leathery's house, and I was on drums. And then first year of college, we started, I guess, whatever, the band didn't really have a name before Vagina Wolf, so I joined then and started playing guitar with them. And then by second year of college, when I was like just turning 18, we were like Wolf or whatever, or Wolf, and someone like Graham had told me, like, it was either Graham or somebody else that said like, oh, you need a bassist in the band, you got no bottom end.
Yeah,
we had three guitars, it was all mid-range.
Yeah.
And like, I was a pushover, so it wasn't hard to convince me to do it. Like, I was the last one to join as well, so...
Yeah.
I mean, I was kind of...
And it's close
to... The whipping boy.
It's rhythm section as well, isn't it? So, if you're starting out from drums, it's not...
No, definitely. And I was way more suited to bass, like, for that band. It was way better.
Mm.
And then... So, I'm going to skip ahead a little bit, but... Yeah. To, like, arrive on the final lineup of, like, Woo Life, it worked like this, in that... So after second year of college, we had this band with three guitars, and then it became two guitars and bass. And then when I went to university when I was 18, I let everybody practice in my basement in Rusholm.
Yeah.
And it was there that Ellery brought a keyboard along, and the setting that he really liked on the keyboard was an organ setting.
Yeah.
And so we made this song, heavy pop, based on a jam.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The all important jam. And those guys are great jammers, yeah, by the way. Yeah. Blue Life guys are such good jammers. But we made that based on a song, a jam with organ, because he just liked, he hated the rest of the sounds on his keyboard. This is the only one he liked. And then it sort of clicked. Like, we'd never made anything that had that sort of impact. When we made that demo and listened back to it with one microphone hanging from the ceiling, we were like, oh, okay, there's something here.
Yeah.
So, like, the old songs that we had, we rearranged them to be in this lineup. So just one guitar, the organ, the bass, the
with
drums.
With that style. Yeah.
And Ellery's voice.
Yeah.
Now, and another really interesting thing that happens in Woo Life is you is the management that you get on board, because I'm curious to sort of try and pinpoint what happens with when you're starting to do that monthly residency at the coffee shop, which is now a North Star Deli, but back in the day it was called Outlet, and it's right by Piccadilly Station. If no one's ever been to Manchester, if you don't know where it is, it's on Dale Street.
I saw Woo Life there.
Yeah, and that is where you guys really made an impression on the industry, and it's the beginning of where you started doing it on a world stage, because you guys never really toured the UK. You went straight into touring the world straight away. I remember thinking, this is madness, because you guys would just be putting up posters for gigs on Facebook or whatever, and it'd be like, yeah, we got another gig. It's like, oh, is it Manchester? It's like, no, it's Switzerland. Like, oh, we got another gig. Oh, where is it? It's like, it's Coachella. It's like, what's going on? You've not even played Norwich yet. You can't just bypass Norwich, mate. I'm sorry, I'm shaking my finger face.
I just got finger wags. Yeah,
but the way that it was carved out and the way that you guys made this Whispering campaign to a T, it was perfect. Like, I don't want to call it hype, because it was justified. Like, it was hype.
We were a product of the internet. Like, that's exactly, we were one of the first bands to really succeed on the back of being something that was just, it wasn't a media hype thing, it was an internet media hype thing, which was only just happening in about 2009.
Mm.
Yeah.
Really, 2010 for the first time.
But did you traditionally have music management, did you? Like, was it? I'm not asking for any names on this or anything like that. but what kind of manager did you have at that point? Because it was it still Graham from Blowout? It wasn't, was it?
After Graham, we had I think Evans spoke to his art teacher, and like maybe gave his art teacher some music that we'd done, like some demos, and Evans's art teacher knew Warren Bramley, who became our manager.
Oh, okay.
And then Warren got in touch with us and said, like, hey, you're playing a show soon. I'd like to come watch you. And so he watched us at that Castle gig that I told you before, with the dripping, leaking buckets. And
the woman with the flush.
And the woman who went to the toilet. So he came, and then like he like helped us get a practice room, helped us get set up. Okay. He had a creative agency called 43.
Okay.
And so he was managing a couple of other groups, and he really helped us a lot. Like he gave us some money so that we could have a practice room, because it's really expensive in Manchester.
Yeah. Of course. Yep.
And then like he had some contacts so that we could have a PR straight off.
Yeah.
So
yeah, because I remember hearing like rumors that your management were sort of behind the latest branding for Coca-Cola and things like that. There was just like so much
not
of that
Coca-Cola,
kind of
Coca-Cola, but Adidas.
But that's all kind of like
Adidas UK.
Fair enough. Yeah, it's so that's weird. I remember that rumor as well. It's like, yeah, they got the guy who invented Coke managing the mouse.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like what's going
but
on?
Really?
It's like
but
yeah.
The thing is though, I just don't feel like. Like, it wasn't my dad or anything.
No,
you know what
yeah.
I mean? Like, it was pure chance.
There's no cheating of the system here.
Of course there is. It's all cheating of the system. You get successful, you've cheated something somewhere. Because,
well, the system
like,
is, the system
we
is
didn't
there to
deserve
be
to, like, skip so many parameters like yeah. That you have to follow.
Again,
usually.
You bypassed Norwich.
No, we didn't. We played Norwich.
Did you?
We played Norwich twice.
Did you play Norwich? Was it good?
Norwich Arts Centre.
Did you play Norwich before you went on Letterman?
Well, yeah.
That would
we didn't
great.
Do much after Letterman.
I would have much preferred if it had been Letterman then Norwich.
Yeah. Well, good. You've mentioned it now. So let's talk about how was Letterman.
That's really skipping ahead. I'm skipping ahead right to the end. So that was in January of I'm pretty sure that was 2012 January, I think. That's a long time. It's nearly 10 years. We found out that we were doing it in maybe like just after the summer, maybe like October or something.
It's quite a while to it to
September, maybe.
A while for it to sink in and consider what's going on.
So we find out in October, September, sometime. Duncan's got sauce on his. And then all of a sudden it's January. I think we have some shows in between, and all of a sudden it's January, and we're in New York for 2 days. 2 days. And I'll always remember this. We stayed in a hotel with peeling wallpaper. I don't know why, but I saw that as some like really weird like thing of like you know like people are telling us we're making it, but the hotel sucks, and I really connected with that. And then the only thing I could afford to eat was like dollar pizza, but luckily for me, there was one just below the hotel.
Amazing.
So we were on like the 13th floor, you know, really lucky.
Yeah.
And we had this peeling wallpaper and dollar pizza, very New York. So we stay there that one night, get up the next day. It's pretty early, like it's a pre-record, the Letterman thing. We get to the studio, and it's about it's getting towards midday. It's maybe 11 o'clock. So we go in the backstage, and then all the donuts are gone. You know, all the Primo donuts are gone. You have like a,
that's fucking.
You have like a crawler. What's a crawler?
Oh, yeah.
You know what
that
is? Yeah. There's one of those.
It's like a stuffed donut.
I snagged that.
Well, it's like
I snagged that. Maybe they know that the crawlers are bad.
Sorry to digress. Talking of stealing things backstage.
Oh, for God's sake.
What have I stolen from you?
Us up late?
You stole my Greggs at the Casimir when I was rhodium. We'll come to that. We'll come to this later. Carry on.
Oh,
sorry.
My God.
You're nearly 40, Neil.
No.
Don't be bringing up...
It was nearly 10 years ago.
Don't be bringing up Greg's heist.
I'm still not over it.
Oh, my God.
Carry on. So you had the crawler.
Oh, what a dickhead. Sorry.
Sorry.
I'll buy you something.
It's all right.
Buy you a pasty-flavored beer. So we arrived. This is just backstage. I haven't even got to the stage yet. And then... So I got this crawler, you know. And then I'm just walking onto like the stage, and like there's all these roadies like moving stuff around, and I'm looking at the backdrop, which is, you know, fake.
Yeah.
Of course. You might think that it's real when you're stupid and young, but then like you look at it and you see all like the sort of 3D layers of it, and it's actually really cool. You're like, oh, look at. Oh, there's the bridge, and there's the, I don't know, I can't remember what's in it. You know what's in it?
It's
I'm
amazing.
Sorry,
it's amazing.
So dumb right now.
No, it's amazing when you don't when you watch shows like that, and you look at the backgrounds and you think, and you don't realize that they're fake until you really look.
And it's so unimpressive. Yeah. It's so unimpressive, and it's like, well, of course that's how it works.
Yeah,
it's just like anything else.
It's not
else.
On like the 50th floor.
This is based
of a
in the reality that you know in England.
Yeah,
and so like you go and look at the desk, and the desk is super unimpressive where Letterman does all his interviews. The chair, sat in the chair, pretty comfy. Not that comfy.
Yeah, just a chair.
Just a chair. We did a sound check even. We did a sound check and super bright lights, and soundtrack was awful. Awful. Hated it. It was like...
Was that not really worrying?
Yeah. Of course, but I, you know, to this day, I still hate soundtrack.
Yeah.
But the thing about Woo Life was that it had to be right in the moment. We couldn't... Yeah. We couldn't just get up there and just rattle it off.
Yeah.
Everyone had to feel right.
Yeah.
And maybe everyone had to feel a bit, like, annoyed or a bit angry about something. Like, I think that like doing a sound check for us Like sometimes we would be purposely late so we didn't have to sound check. We would make our team late because we hated sound checking because we just wanted to get to that city and play the songs for the first time, you know.
Yeah.
And I like that. I still don't warm up.
That's really interesting. And yeah, trying to have to basically fake a performance with no emotion just for the benefits of testing out XLR cables is it's fucking weird, isn't it?
I still do sound check, like, of course, like with Francis Long stuff, it's obviously very different music, but I don't practice singing before I go on. And it's for the same reason. I sing worse when I warm up.
And it really sucks when you're doing a sound check in I suppose the guiltiest culprit on this is whenever we've played Nation of Shopkeepers back in the day in Leeds. Like that's the one memory that always sticks out for me. Like when you're doing sound check to a cafe, essentially, of people that are actually in there just having their lunchtime catch up with someone or whatever. Yeah. And then they act as if you've actually ruined their occasion. And it's like, get the fuck out of my face, please, with this. Sorry to swear so abrasively. But it really is. It's quite embarrassing, and it shouldn't. Yeah, it's not. It's a really unnecessary thing to do. And I agree with you about the vocal aspect of it as well.
Sure.
I remember Hayley from Paramore. She rarely sound checked her vocals. She didn't bother.
Well, there is no need though, really. No. If the mic works, it works. At that point, you've got crew who know what she's going to do. At that point,
and it's
all preset on the desk anyway. There is no need for her to go out there and fucking belt out like.
Yeah,
every room's different.
It's a waste of adrenaline to put that adrenaline into a soundcheck performance.
I think, especially the vocalist.
That's such a good point.
Yeah,
I never thought because a lot of the time I know why stuff is the right thing to do, but I don't know why. Like, I'm very instinctual, and so if a situation happens and I feel really strongly about it, I'll follow that emotion and I'll follow that instinct, but I won't know why. And that's a really cool way to look at it, that I'm not going to waste this adrenaline because I don't have that much.
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah. Because it's still, and especially like you say, Dunk, you might be in a, you know, these days it's more common as well where there are multi-purpose venues. It might be a cafe in the day and you might have to sound check in front of people drinking their coffees, and it's still stepping on to a stage and singing, singers in particular, or performers, anyone. It's still stepping on stage and doing something. It's still, like, daunting.
Yeah, there's still an element
of performance. If you're, like, relatively inexperienced in it,
makes
especially.
You want to click your fingers and start doing a swing version of Room on Reptilia. Just to piss them off even more. You know what I mean? Like, if you can tell that people aren't going to be impressed by the sound check, you should just ruin it with something.
Yeah,
ruin it for them. And then for yourself.
So with the Letterman, how was the performance? Did you all come off and go, was that good? Did you feel like it was good or bad? Or
I don't know. I mean, I'll like before that, you know, talking about adrenaline. We do this sound check and it's really hard. Mm. Like, all credit to Ellery. I think he found it really tough to recreate those vocal performances from the record. Yeah. So a lot of the time, I was like filling in, and so like the long notes and stuff. Like, I would do them, and I don't know if you've ever tried to hit. Let me try and think about what note this is. So heavy pop is in F. So I'm singing the third of F. So what's the third of F? F, G. So it's an A, right?
A, yeah.
Yeah. So try singing that high A.
Yeah.
In heavy pop, and then we'll talk.
Yeah.
So I had to do that every night on tour. But I don't know how long, because he sort of gave up on that style of singing, and he would just sort of maybe more like narrate, and it was just his style. Like as the band progressed, and so the big pressure on me was to sing that note, and I remember like in soundcheck I just couldn't do it. It was really hard, and I was drinking a lot on tour. Even if my drinking had got better, and I wasn't drinking before we played, I would still drink a lot after.
Yeah.
So I would always be like hungover or just about to start another hangover.
Yeah.
Oh, so sound check, like I sucked. It was pretty much the morning. And then we actually get around to the performance and we don't meet Letterman. Letterman's nowhere. But he walked past us once and we were like, hey, we're the band, see you later. You know, like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so we go upstairs and we watch Guided by Voices the night previously. And we watched the bassist like fall on his butt, like, and like really you know, it fills us with confidence. and then we go on. You know,
who were the guests?
It's not like we'd run out of adrenaline in the sound check. There was enough adrenaline. In fact, I even had a beer, like, which I had tried not to do for that, like, after that particular trip, because I was trying to, I felt like it was making me sing worse, so I cut back on the beer. But I had one Corona, I remember. And so we walked out onto the stage. And so I think when you walk out, no one does anything. You walk out and then they introduce you, and then it cuts to you, and then you start playing while they're still applauding. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's always that, right?
Yeah. So it sounds like a weird transition. It's something to do with American telly as well, I think. Mm-hmm. They want the band to start, like, during the tail of the applause.
Yeah.
I've noticed that. It's weird.
Remember, I was super, like, self-conscious about my hair and my face, so normally I had my hair back, like, some sort of faux movie star trying, I don't know what look I was going for, but I just put it all in front of my face because I didn't want anyone to look at me, which wasn't how I normally had it, it's like the intro, like, and then, like, it gets to the bit where I have to do the big note, and I was just like, I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm just going to do it because, like, there's, like, I don't know, like, 500 people in front of me, and they're on tiered seating, and I've just got to go, and thankfully I did it. Like, I got to say, that was a pretty amazing moment to be put under pressure and go, like, you have to do this right now because you're wrong.
I was going to say as well,
slash the world watching you on YouTube.
whenever we've recorded sort of like live extra bits for, you know, bonus tracks on albums or whatever, you know, it's been pretty terrifying to listen back to even those, but I would never be able to watch or listen back to that again. Did you listen or watch it again?
So I mean, of course, it wasn't just my note that was the great thing about that performance. Far from it. Like, I in fact, I had to do another note. No, I'm just kidding. But the second note is even harder when you're actually playing the bass line. But, like, the performance had a certain energy in it that and I was really happy that we managed to, like, convey that. We even swore on, like American national TV. I guess you could say it's cool. I guess you could say
definitely.
I don't know. I don't know what it is, just, but it was funny.
Knowing those obstacles and how hard it is to get that right, does it make you look back on, like, the Future Islands performance with kind of more? Because you know
when
Future Islands.
When we supported them. You mean their performance?
Yeah, yeah. Because remember, like, because theirs is sort of like the legendary performance of our time, really, isn't it? When they did Seasons.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Does it make you think, like, it's even harder to do that than it looks like, and you know, like, from first hand
actually
experience.
It was one of the easiest performances I've ever done.
Oh, okay, well, for fuck it.
But because it's just like, it's like, go for it, it's like, go for broke. But
did David Letterman ask you the question, is that your kit or rental?
No, he said, is that your drummer or a stand-in?
There's always something about the drums, isn't there?
Yeah, he's obsessed with drummer.
Like, is that your kid or is that a rental? Like, you said that a few times. There's like a compilation clip
bit,
online.
Like, every American comedian has their bit, don't they? It's comforting.
Do you want to take a little break?
Let's take a little break. Yeah, so I guess where we left off, we were on stage playing on Letterman.
Yes.
We just hit that second note. The crowd's shaken someone's hand
and he's asked
killed
if
it.
The kit's killed the
it. We played the performance.
Standard.
We started to walk off stage because we thought it was just like any other gig, and that's always the last song, Heavy Bop. So we started to walk off stage, and then we realized, oh, he wants to shake our hands. So we just, like, you know, really awkwardly try and turn around and walk back on stage. And he says that thing, you know, about the drummer being a stand-in. I don't know. He says, like, is that your regular drummer? And then Ellery goes, like, nah, he's a stand-in, you know. Just being funny. Just for a joke. And then it all just seems so much more sinister afterwards, doesn't it? But it really wasn't. But you know, we weren't the best of friends back then. It was really tough. Even when we played a gig like that, it was, you know, I call it a gig. What's wrong with me? You play a show like that, you play on Letterman, and then you're not really super friendly with each other afterwards. It's, you know, it's weird.
Yeah.
We didn't have a good relationship, and we hadn't for a long time, and that's, you know, that's why we broke up. Yeah. But
well, I was gonna say the breakup was very.
But let me finish
yeah,
because
yeah,
like
finish. Sorry,
because there was one moment afterwards when we so we went back up to the like backstage and we all got like late night with David Letterman shirts and stuff, like triple X large,
nice.
And fit none of us. We're all sort of skinny, but it was super cool anyway. We watched some more like reruns of other bands on the show. But apart from like the production crew, we were totally panned and ignored by everyone, which is fully part of the experience.
Mm. Yeah.
We just go through the mill like every other band. Like there's so many bands that do it. It's the biggest moment of your life up to that point. And yet, to everyone else, it's just their day job, you know?
Which is cool.
Yeah, it is.
Because this is like 4 o'clock in the afternoon, remember?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so we're there and we're, you know, watching these reruns of people falling on their butt, like Guided by Voices and stuff. Like, again, having the rest of the Corona in the dressing room, and then we go to a bar, and in the bar, like you have in a lot of American bars, you have a popcorn machine, and so we're like just obsessed with this popcorn machine, like this is the best thing ever, like what an amazing, like salted popcorn, like the best snack ever to have in a bar with like a cold beer, like it's the coolest thing ever. And then I'm talking with the lady who's shown us around, and she says that, oh, Elliot Smith used to live above this bar, and he was just my, you know, he's still one of my like songwriting heroes. And it was just like the craziest way to end the like one of the craziest days.
Yeah.
Just to like end up in the bar where like Elliot Smith was probably like writing some tunes. Yeah. Maybe the B-sides, maybe they never made it, but it was like it's so lame, but I'm a big music fan and I really buzz off like having those music moments.
Yeah.
I mean anyone would.
Yeah.
Of course.
It almost feels like haunted in a way. Like those sort of spaces. I mean, you know, we've been to like studios where people recorded
stuff, and
you know, like Metropolis, when there was like, you know, piano that Freddie Mercury had used or whatever.
Oh yeah,
and it's just something like amazing, but kind of like eerie about it as well.
Yeah.
It's almost sort of like unthinkable that some, you know, piece of music that you loved was written in this exact spot. It almost feels like a sort of like, you know, energy like vortex or something.
Yeah, and the interesting like thing is that it's all in your head.
Yeah. Right?
It's all in your head.
Yeah, exactly.
Like you make it up.
It's just a thing. It's just
but
a place.
But it's still no less of an experience just because it's in your mind.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. You're like, you do build these things up because I've apologized to Freddie Mercury's grand piano for recording vocals in the same... Like, that's the piano he played Don't Stop Me Now on. And I'm recording vocals to a song at the time that sounds like a Miles Kane B-side. It's just like, how has this happened? It's really weird. Yeah, it's weird, but it gives you a placing in the whole world of this industry.
Yeah.
It's,
But just to sort of draw a line under the Woo Life thing, I think what a lot of people liked about it at the time is that it was sort of, it felt, watching it and listening to it, it felt sort of effortless. I felt sort of effortlessly good and effortlessly cool, which I think is probably something that really resonates with those. Well, we were talking about the you know, the Pitchfork top 200, like that sort of stuff sticks with people if it seems not processed, not sort of grinded through the machine, like it was totally in the moment and of its moment. And I was thinking, what did it feel that sort of like natural at the time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it helps that we played that song maybe 300 times, maybe 400 times before, but I think as you were saying that question to me, I couldn't help but wonder about the simplicity of the tune. I felt like Carrie Bradshaw then, sorry. And it really is the heart of it, and the lesson that I learned. It was the most important lesson from being in that band, is that the simplicity is the key.
Yeah.
And so maybe the directness or the effortlessness of it came from the fact that it was very simple.
Yeah.
I remember, like, for that song we played on Letterman, for example, it's two chords. It's basically like B flat and F.
Yeah.
And you don't need anything else.
No.
You can totally use, and I have used, I don't know, I think I've not used every chord, but I've tried so far, and like Francis Song music, but I didn't. You don't need to. Yeah.
And tried time signatures, mate.
Oh no, I mean, like that last record I did, there's a fair few. There's so many bars of six in an eight song. Yeah. Anyway, I digress. The point is that like when you have something that's so simple, sometimes those simple songs connect the best, and
yeah,
and that's what makes it effortless, because it's easy to play.
Yeah,
it's not easy to be yourself, and in some way we were the most ourselves in that moment than we had ever been. You know,
yeah,
we made something that was bigger than ourselves, and it was very simple.
Yeah,
and so it was effortless.
Yeah, definitely, and it was it,
but it had to be effortless. For it to be effortless, it had to be simple, because we were dog shit musicians. Absolutely.
Yeah, but it, like you say, it's the simplicity of the music, but it was wrapped in so much character as well, which I guess is, you know, there's a reason it sticks in people's minds.
The biggest like mystery for me about this mysterious band is just like, you know, the happenstance of it all. Like, it's so cool that I like met these guys, and I just along, and I just like. Like, I helped to make this thing that people really connect to. Like, I feel lucky that I was part of that, definitely.
So going, I don't know, maybe a bit in the future from that point, I first met you on the way to the Brood of Denial, probably when you supported Dutch Uncles as a solo artist. So that was your first kind of foray into sort of those,
For sure.
How was it, that transition from having these guys around you that you were jamming with to being on your own?
Very strange. I mean, when I did, the first time that I played as Francis Lung was after we did an after party, I think, for the Ritz show that we did in Manchester, which is a big one. Because we'd like sold out a venue in Manchester, and we had a bit of a tempestuous relationship with our home city, and so to fill out a show at the Ritz in Manchester and for it to be great was amazing for us. And we had an after party at Crack Gallery, and that's where I played my first show, my first real show, which was me like shirtless like singing karaoke in front of like, you know, these Woo Life fans. And so that was my introduction to it. But I mean, I'd always written songs.
Did they embrace it? Because I remember when we went on tour together.
I felt so good.
When we went on tour together, I remember there would always be like a little chorus of Woo Life fans at the gigs waiting to see you play. And I think sometimes it would work out with them and sometimes it wouldn't. Because they'd be like, why is he wearing a white suit? Why is he playing music off an iPod? What's going on?
Yeah.
Because it was a stark contrast from... I mean, the last time I think I saw Woo Life play live, I think you were shaved head and, you know, topless to now sort
this
of...
This time I, like, you know, had to some, now like, having hair in a crappy, white suit. Like, Leo DiCaprio faux haircut thing. Yeah, it didn't look cool. But for me, that was what was, like... That was what I thought I should look like at the time, so that's why I did it, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, I was a very confused kid. I still am a confused man. And I guess, like, at that stage, I was, you know... Maybe 1 year after the band had split up, and I'd written a bunch of songs, recorded them by myself, and I was sort of singing along to the backing tracks wherever people would allow me to in Manchester. And then you guys like invited me to play on some shows, and I did a tour with you guys. I was in the van.
Stole Neil's Greggs.
Yeah, maybe we should talk about that now.
We played at the
Casimir in Liverpool, and like... I mean, as far as one can slay it whilst doing karaoke before an extremely musically proficient and excellent band. Like, I slayed it, you know. I slayed that karaoke mic.
Yeah, yeah.
Defo.
Yeah, man.
But, I mean, I was hungry too, so...
All that slaying.
Part of the hilarious Dutch Uncles rider was that they had... specific Greggs and specific amounts of Greggs.
Yep.
And I think there was like maybe a bean and cheese pasty.
Yeah, that sounds
that
right.
I snagged, like, you know, I came all the way out here. I'm gonna get fed. Yeah. It just happened to be Neil's.
It happened to be. And I was the roadie at the time.
It's fine. His house has got three stories. It's fine. you don't need to worry about his bloody about his Greggs now.
But yeah, how did you find that tour as a whole? Was it a positive experience? Sorry, you've got a mouthful attack on
me. I love the timing of this question.
Sorry. Getting the grill in.
That was amazing. It was also devastating.
Yeah.
Not just because of the pasty situation, but... like, sometimes it just did not go down well. Like, the first night we played at the
Newcastle?
Clooney.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember...
People were so confused.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck is he doing?
But it was... My first impressions of it were that it was, like, really bold. To go... I mean, like...
Bold is a word.
Yeah, no, it... Like, but not bold, maybe, but sort of, like, ballsy that you went out there on your own and, like, fucking hammered it. Like, gave it your all from song one to, like... And obviously, like you say as well, like, at the time, people were going to a Dutch Uncles gig, so it was fucking... expecting
musically,
a lot of like that, noodling guitars
pretty
and,
different.
Yeah. Yeah. They're expecting a lot of that, and then you open the set, the entire event on an a cappella track.
Yeah,
true. So the a cappella song in question was a song called "Your First Love Is Not Always Your Last Love," and that one ended up on my my first record that was actually only released last year on Memphis Industries, "A Dream Is You." Hell of a plug right there, but. So the song that closes out that record is a different a cappella version of "Your First Love Is Not Always Your Last Love" with lots of different voices that I put on it. But that's a really old song that I sang in 2013,
14? Yeah. 2013, I think.
13,
out
yeah.
Out touch tour, yeah.
But it's really old, but it followed me around, and it never found a place in any of my... on any of my EPs that I put out, so... I put it in F, you know, that great key of F, and it came after The Lie in my record, because that was in F too, and I felt like a kinship with that song, and that's how I started the set. I just, like, went out there, sometimes shirtless, and I remember the Leeds Brudenell show that we did together, that I came out there shirtless, and I sang that song, and people were like, I swear, someone shouted, like, "Get off!"
No.
Yeah. I swear.
Really?
No. Yeah. But that's fine. Okay. Like, I get it. That's not what they were there for.
Well, that's not right, though.
But
I mean,
it's rarely the case that
definitely
support
like,
act like mirrors completely the, you know, the band, the main act, I guess.
Yeah, but it's not often that the support act is the absolute antithesis.
You know what, Francis, we could do your one up there, and I don't know why I'm just going to shove this in right now, but Andy, do you remember playing live at Leeds Festival in, I'm going to say it was 2015, we played at the Town Hall.
Yes, I remember that.
We supported the Cribs. And I remember being quite, because this is just how square I am these days, I remember being quite starstruck by the stage, not because it was a magnificent stage to play on, but because the Question Time Prime Minister special had taken place there the week before between Ed Miliband and David Cameron. No, that's not right. That can't be right. Oh, no, that's where it was in 2010, sorry. So that's why I was like, oh my God, is this the stage where they did that? So, you know, when Ed Miliband tripped on the queue and all that lot. So we were playing
that. Hell yes, I'm tough enough.
Oh no, that was the Paxman thing. So basically we're playing to a full room, 1500 cap of Cribs fans. We're trying to play a song about wet dreams in 15/8. And it starts with a woodwind quartet on a sampler. What do you think's gonna happen? I'll tell you what's gonna happen. Half the crowd is gonna start doing the Poznan and singing a Wakefield FC chant over your 15/8 woodwind wank orchestra. Like, it was the worst.
Fault. Shouldn't have opened on that one.
It was proper trousers down.
Got it, lads.
No
Let's
pun intended. It was horrible.
The whole thing was a car crash though, because we didn't get time to sound check either. We were first
and
on.
The fucking lights went out.
And the lights went out. And the whole that was my fourth gig with you. I came off the stage going, I can't do this. That was so shit. I can't play guitar with these guys. It's really hard. You know?
Yeah, that's brutal.
The short end of it is, when you've had Wakefield United chanted over your own music, over your own introductions, then we'll talk.
Wow, that's insane.
It was horrible. So horrible.
Seriously insane.